Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is Sup Doc. Thanks for listening. I'm George Chen. I'm your host for today. We're a show where we talk to our interesting guests from the worlds of TV and film and all other forms of entertainment about documentaries. Usually it's a documentary that they like. In this case, we actually have a director. And my guest today, all the way from Boston, is Ian McFarland, the producer, video director, director of this documentary, The Godfathers of Hardcore, about Agnostic Front. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Hey, what's going on, George?
Hey, not much. And I was kind of digging back through. I'm going to assume if you have not seen Godfathers of Hardcore, watch it before this. We will spoil a few things. It is available as of this week. I think you were telling me that it's available on a bunch of different platforms right now, right?
Yeah, it's available on Showtime. It's available. It's streaming, and they've been broadcasting it. It's available on iTunes, Vudu, Amazon, Google Play, and Vimeo. So it's readily available on all digital platforms, and then it's also doing a lot of film festivals still all over the place. Brazil, Denmark, Japan, actually, in the Mount Fuji Film Festival. Wow. And then there's one more, if I remember correctly. Australia, the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival.
Melbourne. Yep. We have a couple Australian listeners, so check it out if you're in Melbourne. I just finished watching the film, even though I've been talking to you about doing this interview for a long time, because I am, in general, a punk fan. I am not so much of like a New York hardcore fan specifically. So when I heard about this, I was like, I'm aware of these guys, but I wouldn't say I was like a big fan. And I don't think you have to be to get invested in the story of Roger Moret and Vinny Stigma, the longest term members of Agnostic Front. Seems like they cranked through a lot of members in that like early 80s period, huh?
Yeah, they call it like the revolving door, man. There's been so many members throughout that band over the years that it's hard to keep up with. But you know, they've Roger and Vinny have been there, you know, from the beginning. Vinny started the band, and Roger actually wasn't the first singer. There was actually a couple of guys before him, but when Roger joined the band, it actually then really started becoming like a real band. They were focused in what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And then they've managed to stick that out from 1983 until now, and they're still going today, man. And they're in their 50s and 60s.
Yeah, that is pretty nuts. I was kind of digging through some old YouTube clips, and I saw that you directed a music video for them.
I think I've done four or five of them, actually. Mm-hmm. Done a lot of stuff over those years. I did four or five music videos for them. I did the 2003 or 4 release version of the Agnostic Front live at CBGB's. We did it right before CB's closed.
Oh yeah.
Tilly gave us, the owner gave us full permission to do it. And he gave us permission to put CB's in the name and all this stuff. I've done a fair amount of stuff for the guys over the years, but this film was just a completely different thing in every aspect.
Yeah, when did you first approach them with this idea that you wanted to do this?
Well, I've been talking to them about it for maybe, I don't know, I want to say since like 2003, 2004. I think it started in 2002, 2003. And you know, back then I was a much different filmmaker. I was just, you know, getting my bearings in, you know, my craft, we'll call it. And just really figuring things out. I'm so glad it didn't work out to do it then,
right.
To be honest with you. Mm-hmm. It, you know, the idea of doing a film about, you know, a hardcore punk rock band that has, you know, this sort of following, this sort of, you know, history and you know, Roger and Vinny's friendship, all the different layers that make, you know, this band the band that it is, was daunting and overwhelming, especially to a young filmmaker. You know, but it didn't work out then. I couldn't get anyone to give me any money to help me. And then over time, as my career kind of started moving on and me doing more work and me following my, you know, figuring out my sensibilities and figuring out my, you know, what I can contribute to filmmaking, I started to really, you know, think about making this thing and deciding that I felt more comfortable doing it. But for me to do it, I had to, you know, get them on board. And early on, it was easy to get them on board. But once I told them what I wanted to do, they were kind of like, whoa, what do you mean? This is not about Agnostic Front. This is about me and Roger. And they were kind of, they had to take a step back and go, wow, that's an interesting angle. Why we're not that important. The band is important. And I'm like, you guys have a really interesting story. I think it's more interesting than the band itself.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
So they bit, took them a while, but they bit. And then, I did it. So.
Right. That's what I wanted to circle back to, in the sense that, like, if you only have like a passing familiarity with them, I think it helps if you like punk music to that you'll be more interested in this. But I think the human story is really interesting. And I think when I was watching it, I was thinking about how well you kind of held back information throughout the sequences, because it was like, I'm like, oh, chronologically, I don't know when things happened, but then the way it's revealed is very effective. I'm like, oh, we're still in this scene. I remember from earlier. So they all knew this stuff was happening, but you found clips where it didn't reveal, like there was like some, you know, medical issues and things like that.
Yeah. I started my career as an editor, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't call myself a director for a very long time. I just didn't feel comfortable with it. But a couple of mentors I had, you know, told me, said, look, if you can feel really comfortable about, you know, being an editor, and know story and know how to tell a story, you're going to be a way better director. And, so I took years and concentrated on just storytelling as a craft and you know, being an editor, which I still do today. Like, I own a post-production studio. So I actually, you know, not only directed and produced the film, but I also, I cut the film. Wow. So, you know, that was a whole nother monster. I didn't want to do a normal traditional talking head about a band documentary. I wanted to do something very different. And I didn't want to follow any rules for, you know, the band documentary quotation marks in there, you know, mm-hmm. Which people normally think of when they think of a band film. You know, I think they think of VH1 Behind the Music type thing. And even though I am a fan of that stuff, it's not what I want to do. It's not what I want to be known for doing. I want to do things a little bit differently.
Right. Like, I was also going to comment on how my sort of thought when I was going into it is like, it's going to be wall to wall New York hardcore on the soundtrack. But you have a score that's like a very different genre of like incidental music.
Yeah, that actually I decided that as early as when I decided I was going to make the film. I saw such an interesting story and a dynamic between Roger and Vinny, their friendship. That I wanted to, you know, allow that to be, I guess, palatable for, well, let me take that back. Let me start that over. Like, I think I wanted to put music in that was not hardcore punk rock, even though I'm a huge fan of it and I love it and I grew up on it. You know, it's hard for anyone in that, outside of that music to feel emotion, other than, you know, energy, anger, you know, whatever you want to call it, when listening to it. And, I wanted to bring out, you know, all those emotions, that I wanted to convey in the film. And, I thought that by doing, obviously scoring, it would be, you know, a much easier way, a much better way of, you know, massaging that thought process.
So let's talk a little bit about how you came to your film career. It sounds like you started in editing. How did it come about? Yeah.
Well, even it backs up a little bit more, actually. Actually, it starts with me being a musician. Like I said, I've been part of the hardcore punk rock community my whole life. I played bass since 1997 in a hardcore band called Blood for Blood from Boston, Massachusetts. Yeah. And I grew up on this music, these bands, and I would always be filming bands on the road just because I thought it was just, you know, it was everybody always says when you do a film, do something you know. And I wasn't making a film back then, but I was, you know, in my early 20s, just filming everything I could. And people in, you know, that were my peers and bands started to, you know, ask me to film them on stage or film this or do that, or, hey, we're going to do something stupid, you know, backstage, film this. And so I'd always do that. And, you know, I was in, I think it was in 1998 or 99, I was in tour. We were opening up for Agnostic Front on the road, and I didn't know the guys very well at all, but I was on stage filming another band at this really big festival. And I've told the story a bunch of times, but, you know, I felt a presence next to me. And I looked over and it was Roger, and I really didn't know him then. And I was very nervous around him. And he said, I got, you know, the band got done. He says, hey, when are you going to start filming us? And I was like, wow, whenever you want. He goes, how about tomorrow? And I was like, okay. So I just started filming him here and there. And, that, you know, I guess kind of kicked it off. Once I got the confidence to do that, I started doing music videos for, you know, peers and bands that I was friends with, because I didn't have any worries, because they were my friends. I could screw up. I could do it with them. We could have a good time. So I started out, you know, doing that stuff. I didn't go to school. I went to film school, you know, for a brief amount of time, and then I dropped out. It wasn't even like real film school. It was like a vocational type, you know, a night thing. And it just didn't feel right to me. And I started doing music videos, and I started doing more and more music videos. And then, you know, I was at the same time as I'm filming all these bands, I'm also learning editing, and just reading anything I could on editing, you know, studying editing, anything I could to do that. And then I wanted to, you know, I didn't know anybody in the film community. That was the other thing. I know tons of people in the music industry, but I really didn't know anybody in the film community, especially where I was living at the time. And it was kind of daunting. So when I
didn't have Boston the whole time?
No, when I really started, my wife and I had just got married. We got married pretty young. But I was about 20, and we moved out to, I was 20, 21, and we moved out to Santa Cruz, California. And we just decided to pick up from Boston, give all our stuff away, and move to Santa Cruz.
Were you a surfer? What was the,
no, I just wanted to get away from just city life.
That is the most opposite of Boston I can think of.
Santa Cruz. Yeah. I learned that pretty quick. We didn't have any friends there. We had one friend that was a family friend, and we stayed with her for like a week. But we went out there with no jobs, no place to live.
You're like, I know Blast is from Santa Cruz, right? That's all you knew.
Yeah, we knew nothing. And we ended up, you know, and I knew a couple people in the San Francisco punk rock scene and hardcore scene. But Santa Cruz was very different. So when I started editing and learning editing, I didn't have at that point, I was pretty isolated. So I didn't have a lot of stuff to work with. So, and I could go film stuff. I would just go out and film, you know, surfers or film whatever. And I would just cut stuff together, but it wasn't really giving me like good practice. So one of the things I used to do was I used to take music that I loved and I used to rip Bruce Lee movies, and I used to cut Bruce Lee movies to hardcore punk rock music and all of his fighting. And I would like cut all these things together and like make all these like really fast edits and like change everything. And it's how I learned how to do it. And then from there, like I said, I started doing music videos and then moved back to Boston, teamed up with a guy named Mike Pesci. And then we started really doing a lot of much bigger music videos. And that's when my career kind of started, you know, around a little before that. But yeah, it started around that time. So
just like a weird, like, let's just try out Santa Cruz for a while and see what happens.
Yeah, we lasted about a year. No, I don't actually, I think it was like 10 months, man. And we're like, yeah, we're out of here. Like, this is not for us. it was, I mean, it's a beautiful place, man. But it was, it just wasn't my thing.
It depends. Like, yeah, if you're trying to get into, like, I don't think it makes sense to try to get in the film industry, even though there was like this moment where there was this group that was like making music videos in Santa Cruz. And I think they did some stuff for like Bjork. Yeah.
Well, you know, I can tell you this, though, because I moved out there and I did end up having some connections out there, not many, but very few. When I went back to film a music video there, on the route, you know, on route one, it helped out a lot because, and I worked with the, you know, California Film Office and, Santa Cruz Film Office. And it was a lot easier cause I knew the area. I think they kind of, once I told them I used to live here, I think it was a little bit different. I wanted to come back and film something there and they thought that was pretty cool.
Nice.
So, it did. It wasn't all bad, man.
Did you see Us? But, have you seen Us?
No, I have not yet.
It takes place in Santa Cruz.
Does it really?
Yeah, yeah. Like the, it kind of references that. Like the Lost Boys a little bit too.
So oh wow!
The only filmic legacy I think people know about Santa Cruz is like now the Lost Boys and Us.
Yeah, Lost Boys. I used to walk on that bridge all the time and like just go. This is. I just think it was so cool to do that. Mm-hmm. I've been back, and when I
you can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
I told you I went back to, you know, film the music video for a band called Killswitch Engage.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've heard of them, yeah.
Yeah, it was, I couldn't believe how much it's changed. It really kind of depressed me a little bit. It's there's a lot of really sad stuff going on there, but there's a lot of beautiful things too.
Yeah, it's sort of become a little bit of a Silicon Valley bedroom community, and then there's on the other side of like everywhere in California there's like a lot of homelessness and stuff. Yeah,
it's just there's a lot of just, you know, there's a lot of sadness. I think that's everywhere in the world, but that's a whole nother topic.
So you ended up back in Boston and were kind of able to make this directing. I saw that you made a doc about the Red Sox. Is that right?
That was the first film I did. Yes. I did a film, not about the Red Sox. It was actually about a fandom in New England. I was working with a group called the Dropkick Murphys from Boston who were really close friends of mine.
Yeah.
And I was filming, they did this song. Where they resurrected this song that was almost like a fight song in baseball. It was sang back literally at the turn of the century by a group called the Royal Rooters. And it was attributed to, you know, winning World Series and blah, 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 all this stuff. Well, the Red Sox hadn't won a World Series in 86 years. So the Dropkick said, we're going to bring that song back and it's going to win the World Series. Well, guess what? They did. And so I was filming something for them. And while I was filming that, a little piece, I ended up connecting with a guy who was like an expert on the topic, and we decided to turn it into a feature. So we turned it into a feature documentary, and it, you know, got nominated for a Northeast Regional Emmy. It was broadcast like something like 30, 40 times. So that was the first feature I did. Yeah.
So sort of like the history of the song itself in a way. Yeah.
Well, more than that, it was about the history. That was the thread. That was the thing that, you know, gave us, you know, our grounding. But like the story was really about all these families and this history and this rich history of being in New England. You can't escape it. Whether you're a fan of baseball or not, you cannot escape baseball here. You know, just people that hate baseball still love going to Fenway Park because it really is such an experience to just be there, sit there, smell the smells, see the sights, and it's gorgeous. Yeah. It's really surreal to be inside of a beautiful, like, oasis in the middle of this city that has such history. Yeah. I'm a baseball fan, but I'm not a diehard baseball fan by any means, but I just like history and I like Boston history. I think it's really interesting.
It seems like there's sort of this thread of like male bonding through all your films with these guys.
Yeah, yeah, you know what? It's funny. It's funny you say that because it's something that I thought about the other day. I was like, man, I need to do some stuff on some like inspiring women. I have to do that. I have a little girl, and it's something I was actually talking to my wife about recently. I was like, man, it's funny you notice that. So that actually even pushes me more. I was like, man, I do have to do something. So,
And also I guess the kind of extended family and sort of chosen family is at the heart of this film, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. And yeah, just trauma, a lot of childhood trauma. And like, that's, I feel like there's a lot of stuff. Like also, even when you look at like, you know, hip hop documentaries, they talk about New York in the late 70s, early 80s, and how dangerous it was. And I haven't seen a lot of representation of like sort of this Lower East Side squat kind of scene, you know, which you kind of recreated, right? Is the only kind of recreated footage that intro that you did?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. That's it. There was, I take that back. There was a couple, but the only scene I recreated was the title sequence. And I'm not really into doing recreation type, you know, documentary stuff, unless it's something like Errol Morris doing like Wormwood, which is just, that's a whole nother world, or like The Imposter, you know, or.
Oh man, The Imposter. You know, like yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Simon Chin, one of the best executive producers in the world. The guy has changed filmmaking, in my opinion, with the films that he's done. But The Imposter is one of my favorite films ever made, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
It inspired me a lot with this thing, to be honest with you too. Mm-hmm.
The revealing of layers is interesting. Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I recreated I thought it was okay to recreate something in a title sequence. And the reason I recreated it was because I wasn't ever planning on doing that, but I found this old footage, that ended up, it opens a scene, and I just didn't want to play it on a TV. I was like, man, you know, people aren't going to really, you know, understand this, you know, and they're going to think it's somewhat of a joke. And I was like, what would it be like if these kids were sitting around, they saw it come on the TV? Because, you know, it was an NBC, it was Channel 4, I think, NBC, in 1983. I'm pretty sure it was 83 or 84. I think it was 83 that aired. But, you know, they're just mocking it. You know, the news reporters are kind of like, you know, it's a little bit, in my opinion, it's funny now, but I can imagine back then it would really piss those kids off that were dedicating their lives to, you know, living in squats and going against society. Mm-hmm. They're like, you know, I think they just kind of, at that point we're just like, you know, whatever, this is just one more point where people just don't understand us. And that's kind of the core of, you know, any kind of fringe music is being misunderstood, you know?
Yeah. I was just thinking of, did you see, I imagine you saw American Hardcore, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
I remember seeing that.
I was waiting
in theaters,
for that sucker to come out.
Yeah.
I did see in a theater. Yes, I did. I saw I think it was a Kendall Theater in Boston. I was pumped, you know. Those it's just a very different type of film. Mm-hmm. It's funny because people will, you know, they haven't seen the film, you know, like, oh, you know, like American Hardcore. I'm like, no, it's very, you can't really compare my film to that one. They're very different. Mm-hmm. I love American Hardcore. I think it's a really great film, but that's in a way like a discography kind of like, you know, over time of a topical kind of thing. Right. My film's about mortality. My film's about mortality and following mm-hmm. your dreams, and not so much about hardcore as it is about these two guys that have been in hardcore for their entire lives and they know nothing else.
I would also throw in sort of like a genre, like documentaries, like you're saying, like that are just sort of like, here is a scene. Like, I actually like didn't particularly like that DC punk documentary that came out, Salad Days.
Which one? Salad Days. I haven't seen that one yet.
Not to denigrate. I mean, like, it was definitely, like, interesting all put together, but it did definitely felt more like a book report about, you know, a time. Mm-hmm. But the films that I think are, like, about artists that kind of delve into more of this sort of, like, human story, like, I would say, like, Devil and Daniel Johnston and, like, Crumb would be really good, like where you can go in with knowing very little about the topic, you get a little bit of the topic, but then you really just get like, whoa, there's this crazy, you know, family story to this.
Yeah, that's the type of stuff that I wanted to do. That's the type of films that I want to do.
Yeah, and I would say, like, yeah, if you go into this thinking it's going to be more of the first kind, it's more of a, like, just really about the human family story and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a character study. It's a mm-hmm. portrait, you know, on these two guys. And the thing that gets us there is, you know, a band and a culture, and that's really it. But you know, it's funny, like I can tell you the films that inspire me the most to make this film. I would say like 20,000 Days on Earth.
The Nick Cave thing. Yeah.
Nick Cave. Like it's just phenomenal.
A lot of recreations in that one though. That was all mostly recreations.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the whole thing pretty much is.
Except for some of the live footage. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's that. I would say Dark Star. If you haven't seen that, you need to see that. That's, it's on H.R. Geiger.
I have not.
So good.
You know, that kind of connects to like my sort of general connection to some of this stuff is I actually worked for Alternative Tentacles for a while.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't realize that, Nadia's mom was a singer of Nausea. I kind of just like went down a little like Wikipedia hole after. I'm like, what? Okay. What a weird connection.
and you want to, I'll throw a little bit more and that will blow your mind. All those photos in the film, those are all taken by her. Those unbelievable. She was going to NYU. She was a film student at the time in 1981, 1983, 1984. She was going to NYU, and she's hands down one of my favorite photographers, I think, in the world. Mm-hmm. And she, you know, let us use, basically, she gave me her entire, like, arsenal of photos.
All the kid photos and everything. Yeah.
Oh man. It was incredible. Yeah. Roger had never seen 90% of this stuff. She had never printed, you know, 3/4 of it.
There were scans of negatives, or did you get prints made too?
No, what we did is we scanned in negatives. Mm-hmm. I scanned them in low res. We used what we wanted. I mean, I didn't scan in everything. There's just no point. But, mm-hmm. She was basically, you know, embedded in a scene and, you know, embedded in, you know, she was living it too. She was living in the squats, you know, and she was she was in a really awesome, you know, real deal hardcore, you know, punk rock band. And so you had like, you know, Amy Keim, who's, you know, the singer of Nausea, and then you have Roger Moret, who's the singer of Agnostic Front, and they come together and they're like, you know, just this power group or something, power couple, mm-hmm. in a small little scene. And then you know, they're living in squats and really living in squats, and then they had a baby. Mm-hmm. And then they continued to live in squats, and Nadia grew up in New York City squats. And now today she's pretty remarkable, you know, young woman. She's in her, I think she's 31 now, 30, maybe 30. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah.
And they talk about like her sleeping in a drawer and him needing to like, yep. figure out a way to make money and stuff. And so I was like, oh man, this for when I see him, like, kind of like, it's already a little bit jarring, the difference between how Vinny lives in New York and then just seeing him in this super suburban Arizona kind of like backdrop. It's with a pool and the dog and everything. It's just like such an interesting, that's why, like, when there's sort of like this flip that happens like three quarters through the film that I did not see coming at all. Like, I'm like, this guy seems like the together guy. And then it's like, oh, whoa, there was like so much going on behind that control issue.
There's so many interesting things like with this film that you know, I knew while I was making it, and I hoped people would recognize and see it. I'm glad you pick up on these little flips, because, you know, think of it this way. You know, you have Roger, who grew up just a horrific childhood. Absolutely horrible. And you have Vinny, who grew up in a loving family, in New York City, in a small little neighborhood. And then Roger comes to the United States. He's a Cuban refugee, comes over on freedom flights. I think that's what he called it. Mm-hmm. He gets over here, and, you know, and then everything really starts going really to hell when he gets here. Because, you know, he comes over with three young kids under the age of, I think they were all under the age of like seven, I think. And with a mother that spoke zero English. And, you know, it was all about survival for them and just trying to, you know, have a better life. And, you know, things didn't work out in a lot of ways for them in the short term, but in the long term they did. And if you look at Roger now, he's lived life, you know, on the real hard side, but now he's kind of, I think, reaping the benefits of all that, you know, plowing through all that hard work. He has a wonderful family. He has a great relationship with his former family, his current family, his children. And then you have Vinny, who now, you know, he's now grew up in this neighborhood that he loved so much, and now he's watching it completely change. And gentrification is just tearing apart, you know, that part of New York, that old part of New York. And Vinny's not happy about it. He's really upset about it. And when I say it hurts him, I mean, it really physically hurts the man.
Yeah.
Because he just wants to go back to, you know, it being the way it was, you know, in that little neighborhood. Now he doesn't know any of his neighbors. He lives in the same building that he was born in. He was born downstairs. He lives in the apartment right above it. He won't give it up. They try to get him out of there. He just won't give it up. He's like, nope, I'm not leaving.
Well, people are actively trying to like buy the building.
Oh, they tried to for a while, you know, but, you know, I can tell you this though. I mean, he's now 64 years old. Mm-hmm. Good luck getting a 64-year-old out of an apartment now in New York City.
Yeah.
They're
still renters of the whole thing?
Oh yeah, I think it's all renters in the
That's great. Yeah, like they can fight those developers. That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah, and Vinny's, you know, he's very, even the first scene you can see in the film. I mean, mm-hmm. he's genuinely upset the way that the city has just changed. He doesn't he looked at New York City as such a community and such a great place to be, and now he's like, nobody knows anybody. You walk by everybody, you know, there's a part of the scene where he's walking down the street and he's telling me something, then he goes, nah, now it's time to walk amongst the dead. And then he just, you know, there's an adult moment with that man on camera, to be honest with you. You know, I could have made this movie 5 hours. I'll be honest with you. There's so much material, and that's one of the hardest things about making a film, I think, is knowing when to say when and when to say, okay, this is, what's the focus here? You know, mm-hmm. You know, it's easy to make a film, a long film. It's much harder to make a shorter one, and still try to get a point across, mm-hmm. Or, you know, whatever you're trying to say, period, you know, or the film is trying to say, you know?
So, In that vein, when you made your first cut, how long was it?
My first cut was only, I think, 3 hours.
Okay.
It was like 3.5. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of just, you know, strung out conscious thoughts, you know. I can tell you though, you know, the way I do films is a little bit different than I think some people. I start all my films, everything I do, with really high-end audio recordings. No cameras, no lights, nothing, just audio recordings. And I use those for two things, research, and, you know, kind of developing of my story. And then I also use that for the film later on. And I tested this out for a while by doing a couple shorts where I would, make these guys, I would do shorts on people where I just did audio recordings, and then I would shoot, you know, stuff over the top. But before I even went and shot stuff, I would then edit all the audio together and I would score the audio. And then I would go and decide what I wanted to shoot over the top. And I would basically make a, you know, short form animatics, essentially. I do it in commercial stuff all the time. But you know, with, you do it a lot with voiceovers when you're doing commercial stuff, you know? And so I did that, tested it out with shorts, but I knew that if I had an entire film that was just audio recordings and no talking heads, it honestly would probably be a harder thing to do and keep people captivated. Because filmmakers that can do that for an hour and a half are genius, in my opinion. Like that Kurt Cobain documentary is just insane to me. Like it's
a montage of heck.
Yes.
Yeah. Like we interviewed Brent Morgan actually about that.
I know. I heard it. That's just a tremendous, like, I think, undertaking what he did. Mm-hmm. And I had my hats off to him.
All archival stuff. Yeah. You had a lot of archival video though. Luckily it seemed like there was a lot of documentation. Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I that was one of the things I did this film in stages, you know. The first thing, the first thing I did, it was the audio recordings. And when I did the audio recordings, I then came back and cut those first, and I cut all of the thoughts that I could and all the little moments that I could. And then I figured out, okay, this is what I want. And then what I did is I then took and wrote the story based on that on a wall. I said, I have these really, I call them speaking portraits or like inner monologue scenes. And you can tell them in the scene in the film, because it all of a sudden the film slows down and then you feel like you go inside your subject's head and you're hearing what they're talking about, because their tone changes, their cadence. I even made the audio sound a little bit different on purpose so that it would sound a little deeper, a little more like they were putting their head on your shoulder and just kind of talking to you as a friend.
I enjoy myself. I enjoy life. I'm having a good time, man. I always have a good time. And I live like in the wrestling world. Like, don't misunderstand me. I believe in Santa Claus. You gotta believe. You gotta have that. You can't lose that kid in you. You know what I mean? Because when you lose that kid in you, I think you get jaded. But I got a lot more music in me. I got a lot more life in me. When the day comes, it'll come. God wants, it'll come. But until that day comes, fuck you, man, I'm going.
The Vinny scene, that was honestly the first thing I cut in the entire film. That was the first thing that I cut together. And that kind of set the tone. Once I figured that would work, and I felt it would work, and then I knew, okay, I'll do one for Roger now. And then I did one with Roger. We called it Hardcore. And that scene was this, you know, a scene that was the same type of thing with Vinny. I went and recorded great audio, and then we had all this footage, and then I just went and, you know, started cutting stuff over the top of it.
Hardcore is definitely something that's been very misunderstood. It was really a call for justice, you know what I mean? It was really questioning authority, questioning society, questioning religion, just a call for justice. That's what it's always been to me. You could say it's turned into a lifestyle, but that is a misjudgment too, because Adidas is a lifestyle, you know? I've always said that to me, it's just a good judgment of who you are. If you can stand in front of that mirror and look at yourself and feel honest and genuine with yourself, then to me, that's being what I like to grasp as hardcore, like genuine and real and passionate, you know?
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
There's a quote I really love, which is, I want to say it's Vinny's rule. 3 simple rules: no girlfriends, shave your head, dance hard. Do you remember that? That's from the 80s, right?
That was in the credits. They had this rule when they were living in squats, mm-hmm. Because they were so adamant on the band, no distractions, the band. And it was actually, I think, nothing that Roger made up. I think it was Rabies.
Oh, Rabies.
Rabies made that rule up. and from what Roger said is he never abided by it.
Yeah.
So he always had girlfriends, he said. So, but it was, he thought it was like, you know, so we slipped it in. It's one of those things that was just kind of a little funny kind of thing. But I don't think it really had super meaning, if you ask me.
Yeah, just like it's just a fun quote I remember pulling out. There's a thing that I thought might have made its way in here, which is kind of a funny thing involving the band, which was that they were in Matthew Barney's Cremaster, the Order.
Yeah.
The Guggenheim. And I'm sure there was no way to get the footage to be able to use a clip of Cremaster for your film without paying Matthew Barney an exorbitant amount of money, right?
He's a huge fan of AF. Mm-hmm. And I was told that, you know, I could speak with him if I wanted to. But there was a lot of instances where I could have gotten a lot of really cool things that has, you know, been involved with Agnostic Front, but I really chose to not do it. Even like I wanted originally to, I had a whole list of all these people I wanted to interview or get clips from or things like that. And then once I started kind of just, you know, really thinking about it, I said, no, I don't. It's not part of the story. Mm-hmm. It's the story that I want to tell is this really weird, odd couple relationship of Vinny and Roger. And oh yeah, by the way, they play in this band Agnostic Front. Mm-hmm. Like that was like my kind of idea. It wasn't like, you know, seeing talking heads of, you know, Rockstar A or Rockstar B saying, oh, Agnostic Front was amazing. I remember when I saw them at this club and blah, blah, blah. I mean, really, it's like, that's a different film. And the other reason I didn't do it is because I wanted to leave the door open for them as a band to be able to do that film. I don't want to do it, but I wanted them to be able to, because what I was doing was so different that I wanted to it be on its own and its own thing. And that's what they call it. They, you know, Roger and Vinny both are like, no, this is Ian's thing. This is another thing. They take no ownership on this, you know, mm-hmm. in their heads. They're like, this is my story or our stories, but it's, you know, it wouldn't have been put together, you know, with the band story at the same time. It's much different. And if you, you know, if you look into it, it's done that way. It's really kind of like back and forth between Roger and Vinny's dynamic. And you slowly, as the film goes on, start to see how their relationship works. Mm-hmm. And by where you said, three quarters of the way through the film, it's actually around 52 minutes. The film just kind of flips and all mm-hmm. of a sudden it becomes a much different film. Because that was the thing. I wanted to have that part of the film, the last half of the film, the last, you know, 40 minutes of the film, I wanted it to be completely different than anybody saw coming. And that's as it is. Yeah.
Right. Like it's like those realizations, like when some of that concert footage, I think, are they in Berlin or something? And then I'm like, oh, is this a tour that they arranged after he found out everything? That's what I was trying to like piece together.
Yeah, they you know, that was a hard thing. Like I knew that Roger had a heart attack in the early stages of filming, but I didn't want to make it the thing that's like, oh, this is the thing, what's going to happen, put it right up in the beginning of the film. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, Roger has a heart attack, what's going to happen? Then you reveal at the end, oh, he's fine, you know. That's not real to me. You know, it's all about storytelling and how you craft those stories. And this one, I had a lot of back and forth with people that worked on the film, producers, and a couple like, you know, consulting producers I work with. Everybody said, you know, put it up front. You need to have it up front that Roger had a heart attack. And I was like, no, I don't think that's not the story.
Right.
again, that is not the story. There's so many things I could have put in this, but I chose to just stick to, you know, my original idea was the dynamic, the friendship between to those guys. And oh yeah, they play in this band Agnostic Front. And that's literally, like, literally I kept my mantra in my head. That's it. That's what I'm doing. Because this thing, otherwise this thing would have been like I said, like 4 hours long.
Yeah.
And not only that, you know, they, it honestly then felt ingenuine to me. It felt like I was trying to do like a reality show if I put it up front, you know? So my whole idea, since we're filmmakers talking here, you know, I can tell you like a little bit more is like, you know, I wanted the audience to really kind of fall in love with these characters and really kind of, or really not like these characters, but want to find out more about them, whatever. Mm-hmm. But once you're invested into understanding who they are as people, then let's find, or what they did as in their importance, in the music scene, let's find out now really what it's really like for them. And, let's show the flip side of that. And that's the second half of the film that really kind of, gets people. I'll be honest with you. I've been told numbers of times, in theaters all over the world, this might be the only film that I've seen, face tattooed, heavily big, massive dudes crying, walking out of the theater. So, and I can't tell you how many men and women have come up to me, at these screenings and pulled me aside and told me their story and cried. And they don't say, oh man, what a great movie. They say, thank you for making this. Mm-hmm. And that is just the heaviest thing to me. I mean, I'd be lying if I said I didn't have tears in my eyes many times talking to some of these people. And a couple of well-known directors as well that have done that. So, it's pretty cool. I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. You were doing some other, were they like, you mentioned Killswitch Engage, and I saw that you worked with, some other bands. Are these sort of like longer concert film type things that you're doing?
I've done a bunch of different things. I like establishing relationships with bands, and I don't like this thing where in the music industry where you compete with like 10 directors, they say, oh, well, you like your work, write a treatment. And you take like 4 or 5 days, you write a treatment, you put your heart and soul into it, and then it gets thrown onto a stack. The manager flips through it and then says, okay, here's 4 of them, guys, pick these. And it's the artist, you know, sometimes doesn't even see all these. Sometimes they do. A lot of times they don't. And I mean, that is the manager's role, I guess, you know, the band trusts them, but I like having, you know, sitting down and saying, okay, let's build something. Let's really hear about what you want to say, what you're doing, how you feel, how can we fit the aesthetic and the tone of what your band is, or how can we change it to be something new for a new album or a new album cycle. So what I'm going somewhere with this, but like, you know, we did a music video for a band called Meshuggah, and they're a very big, metal band from Sweden, and they're very mysterious. People don't know a lot about them. At least when I was doing, you know, the film, they just have tons of fans all over the world. And, we did a music video for them that was, a horror narrative music video. And it was like a big hit on Headbangers Ball when it was happening years ago. And it was actually one of the first, narrative, metal videos to be on MTV. Mm-hmm. And it did really well. Now it's something like, I don't know, like 40 million views on YouTube or something. But like when we did it, the band was like, hey, you know, would you want to do a concert film on us and do something very different? So I did. I did a concert film with them. I did a concert film with Killswitch Engage. I've done a lot, Agnostic Front, a lot of different bands. But again, I try to just make them a little bit different and have a little bit of different feeling. I love concert films. I love music. And I love film. So combining all those things together, it's a, you know, I don't have a lot to complain about, man. I get to do some cool stuff.
Yeah. When you were in Blood for Blood, what was your instrument?
I played bass.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I played bass. I joined the band. I tried out as a guitarist, and they had a female bass at the time named Gina Bevedides. And she left the band right as I was about to join a second guitar. And then they told me if I want to be in the band, I have to I have to play bass. And I said, I've never touched a bass in my life. And I was a kid. I was a kid. I think I was 19 years old. Mm-hmm. And these are some rough dudes. And, you know, they basically said, you know, play, you want to play with us, you got to play bass. And I said, I've never played bass in my life. And they said, well, figure it out, get a bass, or you're not playing with us. So I had literally like a week and a half, and I learned all the songs, and I played my first show, and I just butchered it. But faked it really good. I looked like I was having a good time. But yeah.
And, yeah, just play and with a pick, right?
Yeah. And then we stuck to playing bass. And honestly, after I started doing it for, you know, a couple years, I really said, wow, I really like this more than guitar. This is way, you know, different. And I found out too that I could drink more when I played bass and play at the stage. So I didn't have to be as technical. So that ended up being a bad part of my life for a while. Mm. We won't get into that. But yeah, I played bass, and I like it. I actually like it more than playing guitar, to be honest with you.
It's sort of like a role that's sort of an underappreciated role, I think, overall.
Yes. Yes, it's the steel ropes, as I call them, is like bass players always get, like, some reason, like the whipping post or something. I don't know, man, the butt of the jokes. But
yeah,
try having a band without a bass player and see how it sounds.
Yeah.
Yeah, you won't have the impact, and people won't feel it as much, at least when we play. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. So you do now, this has been a big touring thing for you, film festival circuit, and your other company, you do a lot of commercial work. That's mostly.
Yeah. I do a lot of commercial work. I have a post-production studio, and I'm actually rebranding right now. And so for the time being, it's just my name and me. My business partner has decided to go his direction and move out to another place. And I am going to stay in Boston and work this, post-production studio. I love having a post-production studio just because it's a very expensive part of filmmaking. And if you can own that, I can cut my costs by quite a bit when I make my films. So we do color correction, I do sound, and we do offline editing, and we do conforming. And then I bring in visual effects guys, animators, whenever I need them. But yeah, looking in Boston, we do that. And then I'm gearing up to, I'm pitching about 3 films right now. Hopefully one of them is going to kick off. I'm staying in the music world. But much, 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 much bigger, artists that I'm going after. Equally as interesting. So the film had a kind of crazy ride. And you know, one of the things that people don't realize, I guess, you know, when I talk about the film is, you know, I started this film out 100% DIY, right in line with punk rock. Nobody would give me a dime to do this film. No record label, not even the band's record label would give me a dime. 2 record labels over like 10 periods of time, 10 years of time wouldn't give me any money. I tried probably, I would say at least 200 people to ask them to give me money. And they like just said, oh, I don't think that's really, it's not going to sell, blah, blah, blah. And I just said, okay, I'm going to do it on my own. Like literally screw everybody. And,
Kickstarter too, right? You guys did Kickstarter.
Well, the Kickstarter was the second thing I did. I convinced my business partner, to do it with me. And, you know, I sunk every penny that I had into getting it going. And then, once we got going, Kickstarter came in, that helped out, a fair amount, but that wasn't even like the full amount of money by any means.
Filmmaking is so expensive.
Yeah. And then once we did that, and I'm still cutting major costs by being the director and the editor, which is huge cost, you know? And then I went and we did the Kickstarter. We then, you know, we kept going. And then once I finished the film, we really need a finishing cost for all the, you know, archival and, you know, all the other little things, the E&O insurance, all those things that, that filmmakers really don't think about. I knew, but I was kind of just putting it in the back of my mind. I kept on like, there's a really great director named Tyler Meesom. He's a really good friend of mine. He did Sons of Perdition and An Honest Liar. And he just did this new MTV film called I Want My MTV that premiered at Tribeca. Not to drop names, but I'm saying, give me context here. He said, I was called him one day and I was like, man, I don't know what I'm going to do. It's like, I'm freaking out about how much money. He said, dude, just make the movie. Just get it done. And then you'll find the money. Just get it done and then show it to people and just do it. Just do the best film you can and then figure it out. Mm-hmm. And I sat back and I just had this, like, all of a sudden this weight off my shoulders. And I was like, he's right. It may not work out, but at least I'll try. And I actually ended up finding an investor through actually the singer of the Dropkick Murphys. The singer of the Dropkick Murphys kind of saved the movie, Al Barr. And he brought in a very, very, very generous, wonderful man named Scott Keys. And Scott came in and just took this thing over the finish line. And then we started rolling. We did about 17 film festivals all over the place. And then I got a really great producer in that time frame. Executive producer named Evan Krauss. He actually just did Apollo 11. He was a producer of that. And then Jeff Casles, who's the manager of the Dropkick Murphys, came in involved. And Skip Williamson, who I spoke about earlier, he's done a lot of big movies. Like he did, he did the Underworld series. He did all those movies. He also owns Revolver Magazine. So he came involved with that. And then, once that all happened, then Showtime came along and, I decided through this whole process that, I was going to try to get this thing broadcast and I was going to own the film. I was going to license it out and then I was going to self-distribute it. And, because I did not want to just, it sat on a shelf with a distributor that didn't understand the film. So, because they didn't understand how to market to the, to the fans of this film. Because it is a niche audience, but it definitely appeals to a much broader audience if presented. Mm-hmm. Hence Showtime brought on, came on board. And then that happened and, Showtime has it until the end of 2020. And then, like I said, we're about to announce something pretty big on Tuesday in the UK. So it's a pretty cool thing that's going to happen. I'm excited. It's being broadcast. It's being streamed. Mm-hmm. Not too bad for a little punk rock DIY film, you know. But I did self-release it through my film company. I went through a distributor and put it on all the platforms all over the world. It's not cheap, but I now have the power. I own it. I get to make the decisions and, you know, I get to screen it and go everywhere I want with it. So, I'm happy with it, you know. Nice. I can't wait till it gets paid off, but, I think that's every filmmaker's dream, right?
Yeah, for sure. I was going to say, for people that are listening who are interested in starting, these passion projects, is there like a lesson in what not to do that you would say you took away from this whole process of working on this film?
That's a whole nother podcast, man. That's like a whole
a lot of not to do.
Yeah, I can tell you this. I think the biggest thing that I've learned in not just this film, but my career, but honestly, what really came to a head for me in this film was, when you make a film, I think most filmmakers just go and figure out the lenses and then they figure out, the camera they're going to shoot with and how it's going to look and all these things. And they don't really bother to think about, what they're going to about to go through. And, especially if you're doing a film about something you care about. People don't understand how much filmmakers put into, their art. And it's an extension of you in a lot of ways. This film, you know, I went through a lot of stuff because it was DIY and I did it on my own. Luckily, I had a great support system, but that's what I'm getting at is I would say the biggest advice I could give to anybody is say, if you're going to take on a big project like this, A, try to look at it not just on the inside, but then go up to 20, 30,000 feet and look at it and look at the whole picture. Where do you want this to end up being? And what do you want to get out of it? Mm-hmm. And two, try to get some people on board and talk to them and say, hey, I'm about to make this film. You know, I might have some rough times. You know, can I count on you to lean on you and just talk to you once in a while? I think that's a big thing because, you know, it took me a long time to figure that out. But, you know, talking to someone and just either venting or just getting a different perspective can really be helpful in art, I think. And I mean, artists are tormented in many ways. Not everybody is, but I now am starting to think of myself in some ways as an artist. It's a weird thing for me, but you know, I got my demons, man, you know, and they tend to come out at the worst times, you know, when you're really, really putting your heart and soul into something and it feels like everybody's on top of you or the whole world's on top of you. It makes a world of difference to have that one person that just, you know, puts a hand on your shoulder and said, dude, just calm down. You're going to get through it. Mm-hmm. This is what I think you might want to do. And I think that goes a long ways.
I think that sounds like that would apply just outside of filmmaking to like any right creative endeavor to have that like support. Yeah,
I agree. But I apply it to filmmaking because filmmaking is not a job for me. It's a lifestyle and it's all I do. I don't think about anything else. I have children and a wife that they are my life and filmmaking. Those literally, that is it. That is all I care about and all I want to do for my entire life. They're first and filmmaking second.
Right.
But the fact that I can make a living at telling stories, you know, my own and other people's is, you know, some people would call it being blessed. Others people would call it, you know, just being very fortunate. I am, on the hardest days, I just try to remember that like, you know, there's people in way worse situations than I am. And perspective and also really, you know, being able to look at your mistakes and own them and say, yes, I did that. I need to fix that. Or I talked to that person the wrong way while I was, you know, making this. I shouldn't have snapped at you, you know, while you're, you know, setting up those lights, you know, can we just take a second, you know, man, like it's hard making films and, you really got to think about it when you do them. And also how you're going to affect everybody on your team and around you through the whole process, because it is a job for some people, but other people it's not. And,
yeah,
it's a little bit of both for me.
I think that does tie in a little bit to how the film ends or how I feel like it does, in the sense of the sort of extended family stuff and, you know, just making up, I'd say like the kind of the relationship between, Roger and his first daughter, I sort of feel like there's something there about like trying to making up for things that were, you know, regrets or something, or like how he wants to live life with his family this time around. And he wants to do things slightly differently and have a work-life balance.
Absolutely. You definitely watched the film. You watched it from a filmmaker's perspective.
Yeah,
for sure. Yes, there's definitely some stuff there. And, but the, you know, the cool thing is you would think that, you know, Nadia would just be, you know, she'd hate her dad or, you know, he was never around for me as a child, but you know, she went through her own thing, I think. And now she's old enough to recognize that, you know, it's not like Roger was trying to be a bad father. He was just trying to do the only thing that he knew was what he could do. And, you know, that was
Stuff definitely was like, sort of like, I feel like an interesting emotional part. And also like seeing, you very briefly see Vinny's relationship with his son. And I kind of wanted to see a little more of that, but I'm kind of like interesting to juxtapose those a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. It was just different. And, and like we had to make a big decision because there is more to, you know, this Vinny story, but like in his, with his son, but to be honest with you, it was just the story kind of just played out that way. Mm-hmm. And like I said, like we could go back and I could cut this. I have two other versions of this thing, that I chose this version as the one that I think is the one that would, appeal to and be the best representation yeah. of this story as a whole, yeah. rather than, but you know, you can't please everybody or hit every topic as much as you want.
Right.
But that is something that I definitely wanted to go into more, but in 96 minutes, it's difficult to do that without looking like it's crowbarred in, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think like the quote that there's a quote in there that I liked where Vinny talks about how like Roger was like his little brother and now he's like his big brother, or like, you know, their roles have
yep.
reversed. And I think that's like
yes.
a lot of the core of the dynamic that's in the film. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. Everyone who, if you got to see the film. I hope you've seen the film by now. Otherwise, I've revealed a lot of stuff. But if you haven't, please check out Godfathers of Hardcore. Available for our UK listeners. Look it up. You'll find it. Yep. Everyone else, Showtime, Amazon, Vudu. You say YouTube?
Yeah, it's on. I'll just list them real quick. It's on. If you can watch it on Showtime, if you got a subscription, you want to stream it. But if you want to help out the filmmakers even more, you want to go to iTunes, Vimeo on demand, Vudu, Amazon, Google Play. Mm-hmm. It's on all those. And then on Tuesday, we get announced for the UK listeners, which is Ireland, Scotland, Wales, and England.
Mm-hmm. And you're also in Australia, you said,
that's a whole nother thing. We actually had to do a whole back on Australia for two reasons, and New Zealand, because we're in the Melbourne Documentary Film Festival.
Right. Film Festival.
And we need to have a premiere there. So it will be released in Australia right afterwards. But the other reason is that those two countries, you have to have the film rated. And it takes quite a while to have that done. It's not like a quick thing. Mm-hmm. So, we're just kind of holding off till the end of Australia's, you know, the Film Festival of Australia, which is later this summer.
Okay.
And then we'll release there. The other thing that's coming out is it will be on Blu-ray in a matter of a couple months.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And it will most likely be a director's cut, which will be different than everything.
Cool. I was going to ask if you were going to do how the DVD market is, but maybe the Blu-ray market is slightly different than the DVD.
Yeah.
Market.
I mean, honestly, the band has such a large following all over the world that, we could do both, but mm-hmm. just for myself, I really just don't want it SD. Yeah. You know, it is expensive to do Blu-ray, because there's just a lot to it. SD is a little bit cheaper, but at the same time, it's like, yeah, Blu-ray is going to be something that will probably be, I'm guessing by midsummer, end of summer will be released.
Cool. Right on. And then in the meantime, they can go to your website, or is there a website
yep,
for the film?
Yeah, that's just thegodfathersofhardcore.com. And you can get everything you want there. Everything is you're able to go through and grab merch. We have posters. We have a lot of cool stuff. So you can watch, like I said, you can watch it on all those platforms. And if you watch it on iTunes, if I had to choose any for anybody to buy it on iTunes.
As they're reconfiguring iTunes to be split into a bunch of different things. Go to iTunes, watch it there, watch it where you can find it. Ian, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to SupDoc.
George, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate the time, man.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for listening. You can find out more about SupDoc at supdocpodcast.com. Recapping reality since 2015. Our theme song was written by David Siegel, and our show is engineered by Will Scoville. For as little as $1 a month, you can donate to the show through our Patreon page, patreon.com/supdocpodcast. If you want to help us in other ways, please share the show. And don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. Find Paco and George's comedy gigs on the About Us page on the site. SupDoc is by doc fans for doc fans. So if you want to advertise with SupDoc, got a film or opinions, hit us up. We'd love to hear from you and what you're docking out on. Email us at supdocpodcast@gmail.com.